Good afternoon, and this is Nido Media reporting on Ohm Radio for Hacker Public Radio. I'm Nido Media. On the other side is Cecile. She Hi. Is a journalist and she's my co-host for today. On the left to me, I have Chiabi from Rizomatica.
Yeah, correct. Hi.
Welcome. And on the other side of the table, we have Bicycle Mark.
Oh, greetings. Hi.
And he's a journalist, and he's also a podcast host for the Citizen Reporter.
That is correct.
Okay, we have two separate subjects to discuss, but let's start, Chiabi, let's start with you. You have a t-shirt and you have it for sale?
Yeah, I'm selling
t-shirt. And it comes from Mexico.
Yeah, I'm selling t-shirt for my project, Rizomatica. This t-shirt has actually been made in Mexico and brought here with a lot of effort. And what do you want to know?
Tell us about the project.
Okay, Rizomatica is a project that want to bring affordable communication to all the people in the world that don't have it, or if they have it, it's not affordable enough. It's in what we are doing now, practically in Mexico, we're basically building community mobile networks for the indigenous villages in Oaxaca, southern of Mexico.
And is there a reason why it's in Oaxaca?
Well, yes, there are multiple reasons for that. The first reason is the fact that the person who actually started the project lives in Oaxaca, and there is a very strong tradition of self-government of the communities themselves. So it's probably the best place to start this kind of project because we are already working with people that know how to manage themselves, and they do it since thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. But they didn't have possibilities for communication. Are they not connected to the bigger infrastructures of Mexico? Or what's going on the communication in Mexico?
Well, Mexico is complicated because the entire telecommunication market is kind of monopolized. So there is the biggest company, which is Telcel, which has more than 70% of the mobile market, which also means that they can do whatever they want in terms of coverage, and they tend to focus mostly on the densely populated areas, and they don't care so much about rural areas, especially because they say that if your village is less than 5,000 people, they won't ever install a network there.
So that's maybe also where your both projects of Mark and Chiabi touch. Not connected, but they are both in difficult areas. But they are also both sort of deep local. You both go into communities that are that have difficulties with internal and external communication for different reasons. I think in Oaxaca it's because of the poverty, because they are really remote, and for that somewhat isolated. And Mark, you do these things in difficult areas because of war, mainly.
Indeed, I do. I mean, Chiabi deserves a ton more credit and attention than I do, in my opinion. You should keep that in mind, because what I do is, I mean, as part of a collective, Small World News, and sometimes on my own, but hopefully always with SWN, we go to not always conflict zones, it could be post-conflict zones. I prefer post-conflict zones because, sometimes people can concentrate better, they're ready to learn things, there's less stress outside, and sometimes it's a good time to develop media and skills in general. But the difference is, though, I mean, Chiabi is talking about a community development project that really stays and connects many, many people. I would love to give myself more credit than I deserve, but I teach young reporters or people who don't know if they're going to be reporters. Some of them use video editing skills, storytelling skills for other work, which I'm fine with. I love, you know, I always have that in mind. But my people are more, you know, handfuls, and I think you're dealing with a much larger cross-section of people using the tools that you're setting up.
Well, yeah, in our case, the entire village, the entire community is actually the user. But the idea is not only to build an infrastructure as a service, but build it more like a shared resource. So not only to give them possibility to communicate, but to also experiment on the idea that if you own your own infrastructure, you can use it for many different things which are not immediately obvious. So, for example, connecting to your point, what we are trying to think is merge the idea of having a community network and make it coexist and cooperate with the community radios that already exist in Oaxaca. So you can actually use an infrastructure as an additional mean of communication, which is not only one-to-one, but it can be used to, for example, one silly example we talked yesterday is the fact that you can send messages every day to everyone, including the latest news, the weather forecast, the price of coffee in that specific example. And yeah, basically develop it also from a journalist point of view.
Yeah, I enjoyed 4 years ago when at was it HAR, we had a GSM network and we were sending messages. I mean, it was it reminds me of that sometimes. Only, you know, you're talking about people's lives and we are talking about 4 days of people's lives here at camp. Yeah. Anyway.
Chavi, can you just tell me more of how you developed the platform that you developed and with how many people you're working? As I understand it, there's no specific sponsorship by Fox IT or Microsoft or something.
Okay, the project at the moment is really, really small. The people working full time on it and with their own money are actually two, me and my friend Peter. We have a couple of friends that are helping out. There is a lawyer who actually made the whole legal part possible. But yes, we didn't get any funding at all. The first part of the project has been basically self-funded, as in I spent all the money I'd saved.
Yeah. And yesterday, when you spoke in the double TP at the Noisy Square about the project, you also mentioned a project that's in Indonesia. And that's similar, or how should I say that?
It's similar in the technical part. It's a working group of University of Berkeley, and there are some students or postdoc, I think, which are doing this project of developing rural mobile networks, and they have the first project in the island of Papua, Indonesia.
Uh-huh. And you also exchange what you're doing. You make it. Yes, as I understand, you're still developing all these platforms.
It's all work in progress. We don't have anything completely stable yet, but we met with them, and we're now doing a cooperation on actually building a common platform between the two projects, so we can then move forward and then do the job twice.
Yeah,
that's the thing, because we are so few and so far in between that it basically makes sense to just work together. Otherwise, we will probably not make it.
Yeah, and you also spoke about the very strong community sense of the people that you work with in Oaxaca.
Yes, the thing is,
like you told something in that small community that people also take all kinds of roles on them, like they have to do like 1 or 2 years police service or...
Yes, it's a thing called Usos y Costumbres, and it's the tradition of the state of Oaxaca, and that basically comes even before the colonization. It comes straight from the Maya and from all the population that were there before the Hispanic invasion. And the idea is every person in the village has specific roles that he needs to do during his life in the village. This is called cargos, charges. So basically during your life you need to do some things which are, how you say it, mandatory for everyone. And then you can basically progress in the chain of command of the village. And the entire thing is managed by an assembly. The assembly is composed by all the people of the village. And every year, they change the assignment. So it can be mayor for 1 year, and then you can become the judge, and then you can become the secretary or nothing.
Yeah, and you also told something about the culture of how they meet, how they talk about what is important for their community. You talked about like meetings that lasted 11 hours.
Yes,
that's quite common in the Mexican climate. I mean,
well, but that's quite common because the idea is that you don't go by majority, as in you don't vote. You try to get a decision which is a good compromise for everyone. I mean, it's based on consensus and not strictly numerical majority, which means that sometimes even a small problem needs to be discussed with more than 1,000 people in a room.
Sorry, it reminds me of Occupy, but anyway, go ahead. I mean, maybe not 11 hours, but 3 or 4.
And they had much less experience and much greater egos, probably.
Yes. So basically it's the GSM networks in areas where big companies won't be will not place them because probably because of monetary reasons. But how are you able to do it yourself?
What do you mean?
How do you get the ability to actually make the network go? Where do you get the people who do the work? Where do you get the money?
At the moment we are in a funny situation because the equipment we are using is not bought. It has been lended to us by a company that produced it because we managed to convince them that we had a nice project and it would be nice to actually start a test installation, and they were so happy about it, they actually shipped it to us and said, go use it. If you like it, you buy it. Otherwise, send it back. The equipment we are using at the moment, it's based on OpenBTS, which is the same software which has been used, I think, at the CCC camp and here as well. Or maybe I'm wrong. I'm not sure. Basically, there are two main platforms to do GSM networks. Both are open source, which is OpenBTS and OpenBSC. The current network is running on OpenBTS, but we are exploring other alternatives, because the main problem we have at the moment is not to scale up, but to actually reduce costs and scale down, because the communities we're talking about, they go from 100 up to 1,000 people. So we're talking about very small villages with not so much money they can invest. So we need to be able to reduce the hardware to the bare minimum and be able to sell to them without a huge cost.
What are the main difficulties you encounter, like on a daily basis?
Okay, there are the
apart
technical
from the
difficulties.
Hangovers of the mezcal, maybe.
That's not a problem. Okay, there are technical difficulties because I never worked with GSM before. It has always been a dream, but considering that you need a degree in telecommunication to actually do it professionally, for me it was a test to see if I could actually do it, which means that you do mistakes every single day and you try and you try and you try again until it works. It's not working perfectly, but it's good enough. Then you have social problems, as in you are relating yourself with a community that works in a totally different way from your point of view. So there is a kind of culture difference that needs to be, I don't know, compensated. As in, you need to adapt to them, and they have to adapt to you. Mm-hmm. I think Mark can probably explain it a bit more.
I mean, it depends on where you work, but you always have to fall into the way things work. So if you have a culture that's more closed or more suspicious of some of the, not just the project you're doing, but the values and you know, who are you, what's behind it, I mean, you always have to deal with that. It could be political, it could be religious. You face that. And then it's gaining the trust, I suppose, of people who don't know you initially, but then I guess you meet the right people in that country who become your sort of spokespeople.
Mark, in which countries do you work mainly?
In the last 3 years, it has been Afghanistan, Turkey for Syrians, okay, Republic of Georgia, and Kosovo, for me. But my organization, Small World News, or the organization I'm a part of, has been working. We gave trainings, so journalism and basically storytelling training in Morocco, Zimbabwe, Egypt. It's been a busy few years. And Libya. And Libya, of course, Libya. You can't forget Libya.
Zimbabwe is interesting.
Yeah, it is. I didn't get to go on that one. But I do get to hear the stories and see some of the results. And
there are some pretty media-wise Zimbabweans who had, I mean, they had these sites, Sokwanele, and made also quite funny jokes, really, with their own information. They have a funny sense of humor.
Yeah, well, the training was actually held outside of Zimbabwe, over the border in, fill in the blank, I can't remember.
Down or up?
Over, to the left. Why can't I think of... Well, anyway, but that tells you something, of course, about the climate in Zimbabwe, where, you know, even the opposition is now not the opposition. You know, it's part of the sort mm-hmm. of the governing thing, and so there's a new opposition, and they don't feel so safe to do any kind of media training, and that kind of goes back into what gets in the way when you're trying to do a project. If a government doesn't trust you, or people don't feel free to even learn something taught by outsiders, then you've got to deal with that, and maybe you have to do it somewhere else. Oaxaca is particularly interesting place because it always seems to me, never having been there, as a place of people who are very independent and very, they don't just fall in line, you know, with what the Mexican government says or whoever.
No, absolutely.
Quite independent.
Not.
Yeah. And you know, you have to deal with bureaucracy. And bureaucracy in a country, in your case, that you weren't born in. I mean, you have to become kind of a legal expert in some ways if you're.
Well, the good thing is we had the Mexican lawyer who helped out with the whole thing, and that's why we're probably the first non-profit organization who got GSM licenses assigned, which is kind of funny because I mean the GSM spectrum worldwide, it's basically saturated. And there is no country in Europe which can give you even a tiny split of the spectrum. And if they give it to you, they will sell it for hundreds of millions. We got a lot for free, and we could probably get it forever, as if we can manage to demonstrate that the model works and the government is happy with what we're doing. So we basically have now 2 years of experimental license to push the project forward as much as possible, so we can then show that yes, it's working now, converted from an experimental license to a permanent one, and then we're done.
I don't know if this is a question you can answer, but I wanted to put it out there anyway. In such a situation, if Oaxaca ever has a large protest movement of any kind, which the government doesn't like, do they have the power to, I suppose, yes, to shut down that GSM network just as they would, you know, in cooperation with a corporate one?
Well, if they send the tough guys, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, we are not officially a public network, so they cannot ask the same thing that they can ask to a network operator. Of course, it's Mexico.
But there's some autonomy there. There's some.
Yeah. The nice thing about Oaxaca is the fact that since the huge revolt in 2006 and the fact that they basically took the city for 6 months. And the entire movement was pushed by radio and telecommunication means. At one point, they even managed to get their hands on the TV channel, and for 1 month, they only made their own programs, mm-hmm. and only women were allowed.
Oh.
So there is a strong tradition of organizing themselves. That's why the project works for us, because they already know how you can do that, and it has been proven many times. Mm. Trying to export this model outside, we don't know yet.
But you also talked about that there's other places like Honduras and Colombia or something. You mentioned other South or Central American countries where there is sort of your group or is looking at it to maybe also expand these kind of projects.
We have been contacted by people in Latin America, yes,
yeah.
because they have the same reality, as in small rural areas which are not covered and where the main companies don't give a shit, basically. Thing is, we are not enough people. We don't have any resource at the moment. So we're looking at it as a possible future expansion. But then again, each place is has its own story, and you cannot export a model because that model will change over time.
Yeah. Hey, and do you maybe have a site or somewhere where people can find out if they would like to support the project financially?
Yeah, of course. The website is www.rhizomatica.org.
Spell it just in case.
Yeah. RHIZOMATICA.org.
Yeah. Yeah, that... Oh, never mind. It's one of those tricky things of, you know, when a project works in a certain place, and maybe you yourself or maybe people around you say, ah, you should do this here or there in another place. And sometimes, of course, it would be nice if it worked and you could and you had the resources. And sometimes you, I don't know, you don't want to overstretch yourself either. I mean, I find I listed several countries where I've worked in the last 3 or 4 years. I wonder what I could have done. Or how much better I could have done if I had focused only on one. You know, how many more people I could have reached. So it's a choice, and it's
is this also something you talk about with Brian Conley of hey, because that's sort of he started to make these small films or have the with journalists in Baghdad to have
right.
these films and so on. But he also broadened his project Alive in Baghdad to a lot of other countries.
Yeah, it's a hard conversation to have, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And Brian's not going to hear this, so ha ha.
Ha ha.
But you know, and he never comes to hacker camps, which is the biggest mistake you can make in life, people.
Don't forget we also have the syndication Hacker Public Radio, right?
No, I don't know anything about it. It doesn't exist. But yeah. So he may hear this, and I would have no problem with that. I wish he was here. But so Brian is, of course, the founder, one of the co-founders of Small World News. And indeed, it started in Iraq in 2003 with the idea that, you know, a country was being bombed again and about to be invaded. And, you know, what if people there could tell their own stories, could tell you not just about how they don't want to be bombed, that would probably be quite easy, but about what it's like to run a liquor store, what it's like to be a border guard, what it's like to run the train service. That was a really simple but insightful series. And I think the problem became, the idea was, just like with, I think, Chavi's project, you teach people and then they do it themselves. We don't want to make ourselves, you know, we do get paid to go because we need to survive. But the idea is not to milk a country, you know, later on. It's teach what we can, go away and let people go, take it from there. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, teach a person to fish and then they'll... Mm. They'll fish. Mm-hmm. I love butchering good sayings. But so Iraq, of course, in 2003 and in the aftermath of the war, I mean, we know pallets of money were flying in. And when it comes to projects that actually helped people, not that money that was on the pallets, I don't know who that helped. But you could do something and you would have resources to back you. Now, that doesn't mean they were from the American government, but they could have been from the State Department. But they could have also been from a press NGO. As there are many. What happens, of course, is that after a conflict and the years that follow, interest dwindles and then money dries up. So then if you want to do a project in that country and you need resources, you need money, basically, if you don't have any support, that's very difficult. That's more than difficult. It may be, you know, close to impossible, but never impossible. Of course, we're at Hacker Camp.
Yeah.
So what ends up happening is Afghanistan becomes an interesting place, not only because, you know, they need all the help they can get, but also because there was goodwill. There was interest on the part of organizations in the U.S. and in Europe to teach people, to teach skills, and to invest in that. And then what's happened in the last 5 years is that, of course, no one wants Afghanistan anymore, not the militaries, not the organizations. So there's a big drop in interest, and you see it. I mean, even journalists are, you know, you're not getting much support from your newspaper or wherever you work if you still want to focus on Afghanistan.
I think it's the same sort of story goes up for Iraq.
Yeah,
and with all I'm starting again to call it the meat machine Iraq, because it started up again, and there is not much attention for it, and there is even less idea of how things could better.
Yeah, and this is a problem, and so, I mean, this is also something for us to discuss, but interest moves, and the question is. What are you going to do about it as someone that wants to do good in the world, that's concerned about people that aren't being reached? that are the most vulnerable, that are currently living in, you know, hell, or the equivalent of. In the case of Small World News, and I can't speak for the organization, but I can speak for me, there is attention to, okay, we want to help people, but where could we possibly get funding to be able to do that help? And so sometimes you'll notice, I mean, Libya, it's no coincidence that in the last 2 to 3 years, we've tried and we've succeeded in some cases to do projects in Libya because there was interest. Now, this is not necessarily a good thing because, of course, you see the downside, right? I would love to go back to Afghanistan. I wish I could teach more there. Maybe there is still a way, but I also see the difference between 2013, you want to do a project in Afghanistan, and 2009, you want to do, or 2008, or even before. It's so much harder, and you're dealing with so much less support. So this isn't a good thing, but this is a reality.
Does this also have something to do with, like, the citizen reporting sort of started with the Iraq war? And there it really got a big boost. Blogs were very important.
Yes.
The citizen reporting, really. Every blogger, journalist, they hold discussions about that. Can you trust it more? But now you see that it's weakening, and are we also not living in an information disaster?
I mean, it's true. The war in Iraq was a sort of a very interesting time for to be a blogger. I mean, we read Riot in the Middle, and we read a lot of great writing that was coming from Iraq in either English or Arabic. But I don't know, because what I'm talking about is more this whole, in a way, it's a bad spiral of funding for projects. And of course, a lot of times you're talking about big organizations who want big money, but I'm also talking about small projects that don't need that much money to do good, but still need something. So that's where it's interesting, you know, Chavi's here, and we started by talking about a t-shirt. And of course, you know, the real reason we talk about that t-shirt is also because I think that you're seeking funds in different ways. To avoid the exact problem I'm talking about, where if you're looking to governments and big organizations, their attention moves too much, perhaps.
Yeah, the idea is that we really don't want any big funding, and the actual business model of the project is it should be self-sustainable. So, of course, the first year is trying, testing, so you're just experimenting. You cannot ask people to pay you for a job that you're not even doing properly. So the first 6 months in the network, we basically did the job for free because they were doing the test for us. I mean, they were actually testing on a live system if the system could work or not, and we were working on it at the same time. So let's say that the quality of service was not great, but we both learned how to deal with it. When I'm going back, we should start to consider it as a production system, so they will pay us a small fee to keep it running. And with that fee and 2-3 networks more, we should be able to survive. I mean, we're not here to make money. We are no profit, so every money that comes in, which is more than my salary and Peter's salary, will be reinvested in the architecture itself. But yeah, the point is we don't want to become another organization, NGO, whatever, which spend most of its time seeking funds. And most of the time, you don't even have a project. You first look for money, and then you look for something to do, while we're trying to do the other way around. We have a target. We have a purpose. Money is just a detail. I mean, point is, we're not going to stop anyway. If we don't have money now, we can wait another 6 months and then continue. Mm. We are not in a rush.
Yeah.
And we live in a very low-cost country. So
yeah, but it's also of interest when you're going somewhere where it doesn't cost that much to get there or to function when you're there. Yeah, that's particularly good. I mean, I've also done projects, I should say. I'm here talking about big funding. On my own, I do projects as a journalist, which have been crowdfunded, you know, and that's, I'm sure, something that comes to mind for anybody. And here at camp, we have plenty of crowdfunded projects. You see them, the evidence of the results. So I've also used that as a method to fund, not so much teaching, but going and doing reporting that's directly crowdfunded from an audience that is either curious of the topic or who already knows my work and says, I want to see what Bicycle Mark would do if he went to wherever he's going. So, of course, that's another question for funding sources.
Well,
yes, Bicycle Mark, you've worked at quite a few different places now. Can you tell us a bit about differences between those places? Now it's different to teach an Iraqi person versus an Afghanistan person.
Well, I mean, I'd rather tell you about the similarities, because one similarity that comes to mind is war trauma. You know, you're in a classroom and you're trying to teach people something that maybe they've never done before. And normally that's already a challenge. People learn at different paces.
Yes.
But sometimes you see that people are dealing with a lot of other issues. And so you've got people that are looking at you and you think that they're thinking of your notes or whatever it is that you're writing, and but they're thinking about someone that is suffering, that has perhaps died, something that went and happened this morning, and it's very hard to isolate the classroom from what's going on outside. And I've never actually taught in Iraq. That was the organization that did that before my time, but I've seen this in Afghanistan, and I've seen this now with Syrians. Of course, if you want to start listing differences, you know, there's the man-woman thing. Sometimes that's it's always been a complicated issue for me, where you have classrooms, especially in Afghanistan, where there are very few women, and the women that are there are not always treated as equals. They're not treated badly. Well, that's okay. Maybe they are. They're somewhat ignored, which I would probably put to being treated badly. And that's odd, you know, because you're trying to teach them as equals, and half of their classmates are ignoring them, and they themselves sometimes play down their role. Mm-hmm. No, don't help me, go help him. Mm-hmm. No, I don't really need anything. And you know they do need some, you know, they need some attention, some hands-on right there. So for me, it's often been this kind of cultural difference that makes teaching very difficult. So,
do you also have women in your own organization to sort of challenge that?
Not actively doing teaching right now. In the past, we've had people working for us, females, but at the moment, we don't have any trainers that I know of.
Because then, of course, you would work with other role models in these situations, and that would also complicate things, but it would also be good for women that would want to learn things.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Afghanistan, of course, has since a long time already these stories about illegal schools for girls.
Yeah, well, now legal, very legal. I mean,
before the last decade started.
I don't know, because I fell into this, so that is a question. I think that there has been an attempt, and these attempts have failed, and maybe we should try harder. The other question is, how much, I don't know, is it not tempting to work with us for some reason for females? I have no idea. It's definitely worth finding out. I don't have a good answer for that.
Good.
And then, you know, differences go on and on. I mean, I would rather answer more specific questions about differences, but because in general, it's just too much.
I also can imagine that in the Syrian chaos, I mean, nobody really seems to understand anymore what's going on. Everything is worsening.
And the Syrian thing is complicated above all because the people that we teach are, from the start, they're with the rebels, okay? And I have no problem with that, except that they're not that old idea of a journalist that has no affiliation or some kind of independence. They have to be, I think they have to, be against the people that are bombing them. Mm-hmm. And so it's the government that's bombing them. Mm-hmm. So although they're journalists, they're reporters, but they are with an army. Mm-hmm. They don't pick up guns, but they go with them. Mm-hmm. And they trust, to some extent, they trust them. Mm-hmm.
The army changed. In a way,
it depends on where you are in the country, and it depends. So they don't agree with everybody that's that army that they're with, not the army, but with the rebels. Mm-hmm. I want to say the rebels. So this is not unique, but it's special to the Syrian case, because you're talking to journalists, but you're talking to journalists who are almost affiliated with the military. Mm-hmm. Is that good or bad? It affects how they do their job. Mm-hmm. And so if you talk about interviewing and you say, why don't you ask, you know, the general so-and-so of the rebels about this event that happened? They'll say, well, you can't ask our generals that. You know, they really respect these sort of rules of, he's too high up for me to ask that. He'll get mad. I'm not going to do that. And I think that partially comes with when you really support a certain side, you know, mm-hmm. and when you're just scared, that's another thing.
You're
just scared to be shut out, to be hurt.
Yeah.
You know, that happened a lot. You could see footage of students of something that the rebels did that perhaps the rebels don't want published, and students would say, "Look, I'm showing you this, but you can't show anyone because I got to go home, and they're there."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is really complicated. Mm-hmm. This is really difficult.
So are you also talking about how to make footage like that that could also make the dangers for the persons involved bigger? Are you talking about how you could sort of make this this kind of footage less dangerous, like take out the very clear recognizable parts or whatever, but that the real note of the footage remains?
Yeah, I mean, you try and teach, and they're interested, of course. Once you get them out of their shells, they're interested in taking some risks. You know, you see, I tried to show a little here, footage of hidden camera video mm-hmm. taken in a community or in a city where it's run by the government, and they're not supposed to be, no one is supposed to be running around with a camera. And you'll see them, it's terrible quality video, and it's shaky, and you can't see much of what's going on. And then they'll say, "Oh, I risked my life for this video. What do you mm-hmm. think?" Mm-hmm. And you're like, all right, what we need to do is help you so that next time you risk your life, because I know you're going to do it, you know, because you're dedicated, mm-hmm. that you don't shake like crazy and get only pictures of tops of trees. You know, if you're going to risk your life, let's make it, dare I say, somewhat more worth it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that mm-hmm. it's a message that people could process. And then there's other things, you know, and you get into that discussion, you have to learn about culture to some extent, but how do you talk to a general who thinks that reporters shouldn't ask nosy questions?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are there ways? And we talk about getting, you know, a little more like friends with your sources mm-hmm. and choosing the right time to ask the more difficult question. And it's all very basic journalism skills, which you either learn with experience or maybe somebody can show you. I mean, it's either or.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Xavi, do you also have, Mark is talking about hierarchy also in working with the rebels. And is there something with hierarchy in your project in Mexico that makes things more difficult or even more easy, or does it? Is there no such a thing as hierarchy, and is there far more a really communal sense?
Officially, there are no hierarchies. I mean, you have places of power which rotate. So, in theory, there is no possibility to create a hierarchy. Unofficially, you always have different powers in a community. So you can have one family, you can have a group of people, you can have certain people that tend to put pressure on you, for you or against you. And I mean, the world is the same. I mean, people are the same everywhere. You will never find a single community which agree with you 100%. And even if you do, there's always going to be someone who tries to make his own personal business out of it. I mean, with us, it happened a lot that some people in the village spread around misinformation about what we're doing, and the fact that the equipment we're using is not up to date, and we're basically selling them obsolete crap.
And but why is that? Is that because you are new into the community, or
no? We found out. We investigated a bit, and there is one guy who is basically making secret deals, or is trying to make a secret deal with the actual big telco. And so he's trying to push us out. Of course, this doesn't work because the network we have is already running and the big telco doesn't really want to invest money in it. But this guy is still thinking, you see, that's the problem. Even if you're working in indigenous communities which keep the same mentality they had since hundreds of years, the new way of thinking, the colonialism of making business out of everything, making your own personal interest above the general interest of the society, it's something that already got there, and you can see it. Oaxaca is probably one of the few places left in the world where you can still count on a community as a whole But you always have to keep in mind that even in a community which is very, I don't know, tightly connected, you still have people that want to make their own business out of it. Mm-hmm. And it's the poorest state in Mexico and one of the poorest in Latin America. So at one point you understand them, the fact that if they had the opportunity to make some money for them and for their family, even going above the bigger interest, mm-hmm. they will do that, and I cannot blame them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's the same everywhere.
Yeah. Well, now we have such a nice moment to put some music, I think. Do we have anything Mexican? Hysterical.
I love the expression from behind the
technical
board.
Technical person. Let's just give him a...
That was a technical look for... I'm not sure where the Mexican music is, but...
I have some music ready for you guys, but it's absolutely not Mexican at all.
It's an Austrian waltz.
Almost.
Prism, watching your every move. Dutch police, wiretapping over 26,000 times. A hacking plan to break into your computer and alter your data or even destroy it. This is Omroep. We love to talk about it. Because Omroep is pessimistic where we can and optimistic where we must. 104.7 FM.
And are we back again?
Yes.
Whoops, we are back again. I'm sorry for the dead air, but here we are again, back to Hacker Public Radio at Ohm on 104.7 FM. We're here, I have Cecile with me, who's playing the role of a co-host, which I'm very grateful for. And we have, to my left, we have Chabi of Rinsnomatica. And
Rinsnomatica.
I'm sorry?
It's not Nomatica, it's Omatica. Oh,
Rinsnomatica.
Yeah.
That's happy. Okay, great. And we had Bicycle Mark with us a moment ago, but he had to go because he had some heralding work to do. So we had to excuse him. Okay. So Chabi, we were talking about the project, and you talked about what. The OpenBTS, the software that you used. Could you perhaps say something more about that?
Yeah, okay. Basically, OpenBTS...
We're still talking about Chabi's project in Oaxaca,
yeah,
Mexico.
Basically, OpenBTS, it's a software platform which allow you to set up your own GSM cell with very little money. In the cheapest option, with less than €1,000, you can actually set up a small cell yourself. The idea... The revolution in GSM technology is the fact that we are not forced to use telecommunication, telco-grade stuff. I mean, we can actually build our own things. And it works in this way because it's based on the concept of... Oops.
See?
Okay.
Hmm. We had a little hum, we had a little interruption, let's continue.
Yeah, the idea, it's called SDR, it's not a new concept, but basically means that the entire modulation, so the entire system of generating a digital signal and then creating all the framing and all the technical details, blah, 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 it's all done in software. The transmitter itself only take a signal, convert it into... waves. In the air, and that's it. Then you need to amplify it, and 90% of the job is done by a normal computer.
Yeah, SDR being software-defined radio, right?
Exactly.
And what kind of hardware do you need in order to link up such a village? I mean, are we talking like quad-core, multi-CPU systems, or
no.
Is this like the old Pentium 2 you have in your back in your attic?
It's something in the middle. It's a core. 2 Duo, I think, with 1 gig of RAM, and that's it. And it easily handle 600 users at the moment. And the new transmitter which we are receiving has exactly the same motherboard and should handle up to 1,000 users with no problems. And up to 30 something concurrent calls. So yeah, that's the main thing. I mean, doing something like this 4 or 5 years ago could have been probably impossible, because we don't have the knowledge about telco equipment. I mean, I don't have it, and I know very few people that work in it professionally, and the cost will be completely prohibitive. While nowadays, with small cost and the fact that the entire box is basically Linux, so the same thing we have been whole hacking on for years, it's just one software running on a Linux box, which makes it so much easier.
Yes. So you're basically putting up a network for 1,000 euros together.
No. The problem is, at the moment, the cost is high because we didn't assemble the box ourselves. We just got the entire package fully ready, installed, just plug it in, and it kind of worked. Well, we had to fix some things, but it was quite easy. In the future, we want to move more and more of the finding parts, assembling it, testing it, and doing it ourselves, so we could reduce the price. The actual equipment, which is working now, costs $15,000, which is still around one-tenth of the cost of a normal telephone cell. So we already reduced it to a price which is acceptable for a community of 2,000 people. We want to reduce it down to $4,000-$5,000, so we can actually propose it to villages that are really, really small and don't have that many resources.
Yes, and you can basically do that all by using Moore's Law, right?
Using Moore?
Moore's Law. Computers get twice as fast in about 18 months of time.
Yeah, you see, that's the point. Nowadays, computers are so fast that we don't even need to use the latest technology. We are using computers that are 2-3 years old and they're working perfectly fine, and we pay the entire motherboard, CPU and all less than 100 euro. The main problem we have, and if someone is listening and want to help out, would be really handy. We are missing some radio frequency engineer. The software part, I can handle it. The assembly part, I can handle it, but to actually tune the antennas, to cut the cables properly, to do all the really radio stuff, we are missing a bit of knowledge.
Because you told something that was quite funny about the antenna.
Okay. The antenna we have now, we call it an antenna, but it's a hack. It's a huge hack. It's basically one pole of 10 meters of aluminium with a diameter of, I don't know, 6-7 centimeters. We're actually two pieces soldered together, but when we try to pull it up the first time, the first 2 meter completely bent, and we had to cut it off, shorten it a bit, put it back together, and it's now kept in place with 7 tensors made of metal wire, which is the duct tape equivalent in Mexico.
Yeah, duct tapes good, yeah. Everywhere.
And one time the antenna already fell, they put it back, and now it's stable in place with double metal wire. Which, according to them, it's perfect and it will keep it stable forever.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you have to adapt. You're in Mexico. You cannot set your standards the same way you will do things in Europe.
You have to be more inventive because you have less possibilities to have all the material you just could buy.
Yes. Yeah. On the other side, Mexican people are fantastic because they are completely careless about their own lives. So, I mean, I've seen people walking and climbing 10, 15 meters on antennas without any harness, without any protection. Mm-hmm. Just like, are you sure you want to do that? Yeah, no te preocupe. And in that sense, they don't make that many problems, really. Everything can be done, even the impossible sometimes.
But until now, everybody still survives.
Yeah. No accident, nothing. We are all alive and well.
Yeah.
I use an harness when I climb on the antennas.
Yeah. Justo.
Okay. What else? If someone wants to know more about this project, they can always pass by the Italian embassy, which is in the most noisy part of the camp. I will be there. And you can also buy t-shirts. You can drink
some. The noisy
some
rebel camp square.
Exactly. We're in front of the noisy square. We are the noisy Italians.
where there was no discussion about the sponsorship of this conference. No such discussion.
Okay. Let's see.
What will be the next program? Is anybody aware of what...
I guess it will be Brno.
Ah.
Okay. Can you tell us a bit about what happens after you've been there and brought the stuff and set up the network, and it gets taken over by the local people? And have you been there in a later stage after they have controlled the system themselves for a while?
Yeah. We actually went there already 5-6 times by now, which, yeah, we're basically friends by now. We go back and forth a lot. What we found out is that they use the telephone a lot. I mean, they make on average 4,000 calls per day, and they are what, less than 600 users. So on average, they call at least 5 times a day. They find it really, really useful, especially for small communication. But how they're going to handle it in the future and what are going to be the actual consequences for the society as a whole, we don't know yet. We think that it's a positive improvement, and they were the first to actually request that. I mean, we didn't force anything. We made the proposal and they accepted it, but there is no... We want to avoid the approach many NGOs and groups have, which is we go to a place and we tell them that it will be nice to do that, and we do it, and that's it. Our approach is more a dialogue, as in we would like to do this, but we understand that you have different requirements, or maybe what we think that you could do with that, it's completely different from what you think it could be useful. So it's going to be very interesting in the next 1-2 years to see if we can really make a difference, and if this difference is positive or negative, or if we just created another monster full of teenagers texting each other.
I still don't get how did you end up at exactly that place? Because you had plans for, like, I don't know.
Totally
you would have started in Central America, and you would be away for a year, and you would have sort of traveled the whole South of America or something.
Yeah, but my
trip only lasted. You never got out of Mexico.
Yes, I never got out of Mexico. The southern place I got was Oaxaca. No, it happened that I've been to the Mexican HEC meeting, which is the equivalent of the home camp, but it's done every year, and it's a bit more, I don't know, on the cheap side. But basically,
how big is that? Are there many people?
100-something people.
Mm-hmm. From whole Mexico, or...?
Yeah. Well,
because Mexico, of course, has also a particular story of the digitalization, use of computers, and we saw that in the first with the Zapatero movement, with Subcomandante Marcos and blah blah blah. No? So there is a specific, there has been some sort of very, they have been ahead very much on using the internet for their popular movements.
Yeah. There is quite a big support in it. What is constantly lacking in the Mexican part is, like, everywhere. You have tons of people want to do a lot of projects, but they don't have that many technicians, and that always create a chain of dependency between the people who want to do stuff and the people who support them.
Mm-hmm. But the hackers meeting in Mexico, are there also people from the Zapateros involved, or Zapatistas, sorry. Yeah.
Well, officially, yes and no. I don't want to talk much about it because it's a very big topic enough time.
Yeah, okay.
But I think, if someone wants to continue the discussion offline, I'll be around the camp for the next 2 days and you can see me around. I have read Zomatic on my t-shirt.
The Mexican t-shirt.
Yes.
Buy Mexican t-shirt.
Mm.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license.